Presenting sponsor of the Audible is Trader Joe's. Inside Trader Joe's is a five-part podcast series that takes you literally inside Trader Joe's. Go inside the TJ's tasting panel, travel to wineries in Napa Valley and around the world to discover the next great Trader Joe's products. Discover why they wear those super fashionable Hawaiian shirts. You'll find Inside Trader Joe's on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to the Audible. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. And as we were preparing to do this episode, Bruce, we were realizing like not a lot happened in college football this past weekend of note. We're going to have our great friend John Walters on here in a little bit, talk Notre Dame, Syracuse, and college football television and all that. But some people may say I'm biased to say this, but I think the biggest story in college football on Saturday happened at your game.
Would you mean your alma mater winning its division and not only beating Iowa on the road, but also having Wisconsin and Purdue go down?
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, first of all, it's crazy that a 6-4 team has clinched its division with 2 weeks to spare. But, going into the game, and by the way, Iowa was a 10-point favorite. They needed to win two games. They either needed to win two of their last three games, or, like you said, they needed Wisconsin and Purdue to both lose, and they both did, Purdue in pretty humiliating fashion. So tell us about the game and tell us about being right in the middle of it for one of the more memorable images that went out there Saturday of Pat Fitzgerald gathering his team.
Well, we expected it to be frigid, and it was. The wind chill was, I think, 5 degrees on Friday night. It was in the teens on Saturday. And, by the way, your AD, Jim Phillips, he's a brave man. No gloves, no jacket, just a shirt and tie. I was like, are you crazy? He was like, well, the players have their uniform. This is my uniform, so I'm wearing it. I was like, okay, easier said than done. You know, we knew it was going to be a low-scoring game. I did not, I think it was in a 10 or 11-point spread that Iowa was the favorite. And credit to Northwestern. I mean, they lost. They're already down a couple of defensive backs, and they lose their best defensive back, Montre Hardage. And Iowa attacked right after that. And then they were down to the third string kicker, and they still won. And it was a cool moment at the end of the game. I think people have seen the video. So I'm, you know, rushing in there to get Pat Fitz right after. And before that's happening, our camera guys are then, you know, there. He's rounding everybody up because he's going to break the news. So I'm in the little bit of the scrum. I don't intend to be in the middle of his team celebration.
Do you realize at that point that the team doesn't know yet?
I kind of had a good idea of that just because, you know, they're playing the game. They're not on Twitter. It's, you know, it's no one's going to have their phones on the sidelines. It's not a home game. It's just, I think that I don't think they know that. They clearly know they won the game. I don't think they know that they have that Wisconsin and Purdue lost, because at that game, it wasn't like it was, you know, Iowa has a bunch of stuff on the scoreboard, but they don't really have a lot of, you know, it wasn't like you're hearing the crowd ooh and ah over every game update that's going on. So I don't think his players knew. And his SID, Paul Kennedy, had informed him like right after the game. And so he circles everybody up. And as they're kind of all gathering, I'm like, okay, I know where this is going. So like I said, it was a cool scene to be in the middle of and to see. You know, I think that's one of the things we love about college football and college sports is just the genuine emotion of it all, especially, you know, look, this, you were, you know, when you were a student, that was their glory time. People know the history. They've been awful for a long time, and now they're pretty good, and he's done a great job coaching them. And, you know, that was I think on our site, maybe on Friday, Scott Docterman did a really good story about what has become what was a lopsided Iowa Northwestern series, and all of a sudden now Northwestern has kind of molded itself similarly, just built on toughness and character and just grit, as he said it, as Fitz said it, and they ended up winning the game. So really cool scene to be in the middle of.
Yeah, I told Scott after I read that story, I was like, if I didn't know better, I would think you were covering Northwestern in 1995, because he had every detail about the genesis of that, why that game became such a big deal for Gary Barnett and that program.
the infamous moment after Iowa crushed them his first year, and Hayden Fry, as they were shaking hands, said, "I hope we didn't hurt any of your boys," became the genesis of a series where, like, frankly, it seems like Northwestern is constantly like the thorn in Iowa's side. I remember in 2009, Iowa was undefeated, thinking national championship. They beat them in Iowa City. There's just been a lot of games like that. Obviously, this one didn't really impact Iowa other than it's now officially a really disappointing season there. In terms of the Northwestern side of it, you know, I got to admit, I got really into that game. I assumed I'd be watching mostly Bedlam during that window, but as I think once I realized that Minnesota was going to clobber Purdue and that this really was for the division, I watched it pretty closely. Like you said, they had to overcome a lot to win that game. But I just want to put this in perspective for people. I got a lot of, I wasn't even like, you know, tweeting as a Northwestern fan, so just like the facts of it, the fact that they clinched the division. And you immediately get back all the snarky, well, they're just going to lose by 50 in the championship game. Which, first of all, if it is Michigan, the score was 20-17 the first time they played. Maybe it'll be by 50, but I'm not sure where that's coming from. But, you know, you're missing the point. Like, if this were Alabama, Ohio State, whoever, you know, one of those programs, winning the division, not a big deal. For Northwestern to actually go play in the Big Ten championship game in Indianapolis is one of the biggest accomplishments in the history of that program. You know, it's not like they've won the Big Ten three times in the last 50 or 60 years, the most recent being 2000. You know, they've gone to a lot of bowl games recently, obviously. And even those, like when I remember when they won the Gator Bowl a few years ago, that was a really big deal. Beating Pitt in the Pinstripe Bowl was a big deal. Winning this division is a big deal for them. So let them have their moment, you know. Maybe they honestly probably will not beat Michigan or Ohio State in the Big Ten Championship. But I can tell you this much. I'm on a group text thread with a bunch of my friends from college, you know, year-round. And they're all going. They're all going to Indianapolis. It's that big a deal. So kudos to Pat Fitzgerald and his staff.
It's been quite a few years for you. A couple of years ago, Northwestern basketball finally made the tournament. And yep. Was that 2 years ago?
That was 2 years ago.
And now this?
It's been a couple, you know, and they opened that huge, great facility. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really good time for them in athletics. And who would have guessed after they lost a home to Akron and Duke as well at home, although Duke's a pretty good team, that they would not only win the Big Ten West, and remember, go back to August, the consensus was Wisconsin was going to run away with the Big Ten West. You know, we both picked them to go to the playoff. And if it wasn't going to be Wisconsin, then it was probably going to be Iowa. You know, they beat all those teams. They beat Purdue, they beat Nebraska. They've actually won, 12 of their last 13 Big Ten games, or 13 of their last 14, something like that?
It is weird, though, because, like you said, they lost to Akron. They're 0-3 in their non-conference. It is, a very odd team in that regard. You know, we had their game against Wisconsin a couple weeks ago, and there was no Alex Hornibrook. It was Jack Cohen making his first action of the season. They really struggled. Some of it looked like it was some self-inflicted stuff that Wisconsin did. I remember coming away from that game going, I don't know if these guys are very good, but they did win the game at home. I was more impressed by what I saw this past weekend than I was certainly a couple weeks ago. But, you know, all that matters is you win the games, and they're winning the games that matter. And so who knows? I mean, it's not going to help Michigan or Ohio State, probably their profile, much to beat, you know, because if they beat Northwestern at best would be a 8-5 team. So I don't think they would be in the top 25 at that point. But, you know,
I actually think if they win these next two against Minnesota and Illinois and they're 8-4 going into that game, they probably will be in the top 25 just because.
No, I'm saying if they lose it, then I think they'd fall.
Oh, I don't know. The committee has gone both ways on that. Sometimes they don't penalize the team for actually playing the extra game. But regardless, I mean, Northwestern made the top 25 this week at the AP top 25 at 6-4. It's a really weird year where you've got these teams that have been at the top all year. There are only two power five teams in the whole country right now that have exactly two losses, being LSU and Syracuse. And then the rest of the top 25 is all three loss teams. And it's really unusual. I looked it up. Usually there's between 7 and 10 two-loss teams at this point in the season. We're down to two. So it would not surprise me if an 8-5 team was in the top 25. But regardless, you know, I think we both agree that if Michigan and Ohio State win the rest of their games, they're going to the playoff.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say we get to our guest?
Let's do it.
All right, we're pleased to be joined now by one of our absolute favorite recurring podcast guests. He's come on many times, John Walters, author of the world-famous Bubble Screen Saturday College Football TV recap column on The Athletic, and also avid Notre Dame fan who, I'm sure, John, when the season began, you had it circled on your calendar. The game of the year would be Notre Dame-Syracuse.
At least five stops away on the D train from my apartment. It's the road trip that everybody can make. Notre Dame, Syracuse, Yankee Stadium.
Is Francesa going to be talking about this game now that he knows who the head coach is?
You know, by now he probably knows who Dino Babers is. So perhaps so, dog. It's funny. As you guys know, we do these like state of the program pieces for the Athletic, where it's basically giant previews for every team. And my favorite one to do last spring was Syracuse, because I'd never met Dino Babers before, and I just love the guy. And I'm not sure how much time either of you two have spent with him, but just a great person to talk to and friendly. And I'm rooting for both teams on Saturday.
I'm curious. So Matt,
how does that work?
I mean, Notre Dame's. How can this work out for both parties? You obviously want Notre Dame to win and make the playoff.
It can't.
Yeah.
No, it obviously cannot. As you know, just I'm a Notre Dame alum.
You want Notre Dame to win in a high scoring game and Dino to get screwed by bad officiating, so there's an excuse of why they lost.
I have this like fear that Eric Dungy's going to get hurt, and you know, backup Tommy DeVito is going to win the game for Syracuse, and I'm going to hear all these Joe Pesci references for the next 2 weeks. And that could be miserable. And I know like your listeners are going to hate me even more now, but I'm also, because of birth, a Yankee fan. And I'm thinking like my two favorite teams are going to see their season end inside Yankee Stadium. In the same, you know, 6 week period. That's also a fear here. But it's going to be an entertaining game because you guys have seen Syracuse. They're a good team.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, at the time when they gave such a scare to Clemson, you know, that was what's wrong with Clemson moment, even though they were down to their third string quarterback. And now it's like, oh, that was actually a really good win for Clemson. They're one of the only teams
Clemson.
That kept Notre Dame, kept Syracuse from scoring 40 points. But so Matt Fortuna reminded me of this last week. You know, usually with these neutral site games, they're announced years ahead of time. I forgot that this was a Notre Dame home game that got moved to Yankee Stadium just last December, like not that long ago. Given the stakes now, how much do you think Jack Swarbrick and Brian Kelly are kicking themselves that they're not playing this one in South Bend?
But, you know, I mean, honestly, November in South Bend, the last 15 years, even before, that's not a gimme. I mean, Notre Dame has lost to Syracuse in November. I was at that game in South Bend. They've lost to Louisville. They've lost to Virginia Tech. They've lost to Northwestern. They've lost to Navy. Notre Dame knows how to lose at home in South Bend in November. So from that standpoint, I don't think that makes much of a difference. Whereas they're actually 2-0 in the new Yankee Stadium, if I recall correctly. So I don't think they're kicking themselves that much. And I know people have made a big deal about this Notre Dame's traveling, you know, the last month or so. But I think even that story is a little bit overblown. If you follow it, they had 2 weeks before the Navy game, plus 1 week where they weren't even attending school because they had a fall break. The road game to Northwestern, as you guys know, is about a 2.5-hour bus ride. Then they're home. And really the only traveling is this week to Syracuse. And then they're going to go play a team that's almost as poorly coached as Florida State Thanksgiving weekend. And at USC, if USC, I think Notre Dame, it's such a weird year. Like Syracuse is the scary team of the final three.
Who figured that out, right? So let me ask you this. This team looks like it should be a playoff team right now. And now there's no Harry Heistand. They lost that great side of the offensive line, but they seem to have reloaded really well. Ian Book looks like he is throwing the ball a lot better than Everett Golson once did. So I'm going to ask you, do you think this team now would have to win two games, not one, is better suited to win a title than the 2012 team was?
To win a title, yes. But in a world with Alabama, I don't think anybody's well suited to win a title. But they're a better team than the 2012 team, without a doubt. And it starts really, to me, like with Ian Book, because even when I go back to watching him start against North Carolina in 2017, and I don't know if you guys had a chance to see that game, I doubt it, but from the beginning, this was a guy who looked comfortable in the pocket, whose footwork was fantastic, whose vision, this is a quarterback. He's not an athlete who plays quarterback. He's a quarterback. And you just got the sense watching him that if I were a coach, I'd be very comfortable with this guy because he makes really good decisions. I actually think he got pushed back three spaces further than he should have been because of one pick six at Miami later in the season, where, you know, they put him in because Wimbush was struggling. He throws the pick six. And if you've noticed since then, they don't make him make throws like that. He's 6 feet tall. It's tough for him to make throws short slant and passes over the middle because he gets blinded. But when they put him in a position to succeed, that guy just makes really good decisions.
Yeah, I think people forget that the 2012 team was legitimately really good on defense. Yes, Alabama took it to them that night. But in general, right, the course of the season, that was a really good defense. But their offense was basically just try, cross your fingers and hope right, Everett Golson doesn't turn it over. And this is a real
right,
offense.
And then bring in Tommy Rees.
Yeah.
You know, Tommy Rees was a relief pitcher in a few games that year. But what's interesting about this team is how comfortable it's been for Notre Dame fans. I mean, they have led in nothing but led in 8 of their 10 games. They trailed briefly 3-0 at Wake Forest and then took the lead in the very next possession. The only scary game this team has had has been Pitt. And as we've seen, Pitt's turned out to be better than you thought. Like, this has been a team that's really been in control of most games, not in the way that Alabama or Clemson is, no doubt, but they've been up by 10 at least for the majority of most of the games they've been playing, which for longtime Notre Dame viewers post-Holtz, it's a rarity to have such a, you know, cataclysm-free season.
Wow, you rarely get that word in our podcast, Stu. And there it was, cataclysm.
Well, John is nothing if not a wordsmith.
It's close to catechism, and I'm Catholic, so, you know, it had to happen.
Yeah. So let's ask you this. So I try to watch College Game Day as much as I can, depending on our own crew game schedule. But I saw a lot of it. And I saw they were poking mm-hmm. you quite a bit indirectly with some of the discussion. And I know you like Desmond. I like Desmond a lot, too. How frustrating is it for Notre Dame fans to sit back and watch this and have people kind of saying, all right, yeah, I know you beat Michigan, but that was a long time ago. And wait, what happens if Ohio State whips Michigan? Then, you know, that's going to, yeah, they have a loss. Okay, it was to Purdue, and it was a blowout. But okay, you know, they have a conference title game. And yeah, so what? It's going to be against a Northwestern team that Notre Dame beat up on and didn't win a non-conference game. Are Notre Dame fans going feeling pretty good about we went out and everything? Or are they just, like, getting frustrated with people? What I think is happening is, and Stu, you correct me if I'm wrong, because you did your column about it today. I feel like there's a little bit of manufactured drama from with us within the national media.
Stupidest fake controversy.
Right now, there's nothing to talk about with the playoffs. Right.
Why were they debating Michigan Notre Dame? They would both be in if the season ended today. And if it did somehow come down to some argument between the two of them, Michigan would have no case. Why? This is the stupidest
made-up
drama.
Well, I'll tell you why I think they're making this debate. Besides, I agree with you that part of this is a manufactured. Nobody wants to play Alabama. If you're four, you're playing Alabama. So I think right now that is part of it. What I can't understand is why they're debating Michigan-Notre Dame when the real debate is Michigan-Georgia. That's the debate. Georgia's had a very good season, and I would be curious to see what Vegas would do Georgia versus Michigan in a neutral site. I'm not saying that Georgia's better than Michigan. I'm saying that's where the debate should actually be.
Well, you think if Georgia wins out, that Michigan would go ahead of them if Georgia beats Alabama, that's going to be the best win of the season. I don't care that they would have lost by 20 at LSU. They're going.
Great. Well, wow. But here's some, you know, there's always moving parts. Who's the quarterback for Alabama that day? What happens if Tua is hurt playing against Auburn? But even though, let's go to your question even further. Let's say Georgia wins. Where's Alabama in that scenario? Are they behind Michigan? Who's getting left out? Part of this, I believe, is what every school except Notre Dame has is they have allies within conference among fans. So maybe you didn't go to Michigan, or maybe you're not a Michigan fan, but you're a Wisconsin fan, and you're probably going to take Michigan's side over Notre Dame's side. And I was expecting this question. So I thought about it. And here's my scenario for you guys, if you give me a second. Imagine myself and Michigan proponent Dan Wolken are having a conversation about this. You know, I'm you know, giving Notre Dame side. He's giving Michigan side. And you two, you're both, you know, sensible, smart college football viewers. But for some reason, you've been hermetically sealed all season. And you have no idea what's going on. And you come out of this, you know, bubble, and you're listening to Dan and I talk, and I'm talking about how Notre Dame beat Michigan head to head and actually has a better win against the common opponent. And Dan's saying, well, Michigan, they've improved so much over the year in their defense. And you're sitting here back and forth. And then near the end of this debate, somebody tells you, oh, but by the way, Notre Dame's 10-0 and Michigan's 9-1. You would both go, argument over. Like, why are you guys even debating this?
I wrote this in the column, my Monday morning column. I was watching that playoff show last week when Reese Davis asked, I think it was the first question he asked Rob Mullins was, you know, take us through the evaluation of Michigan against Notre Dame. And he briefly had a look on his face of like, this is a thing? Like, I have all these talking points prepared. It never occurred to us you might ask that. By the way, if you use this, so I think the only thing that the Michigan proponents would have in this fake debate is that the advanced stats are on their side. And so, like, if you, I looked up Sagarin ratings just because you had asked about, or you mentioned Georgia, Michigan. Well, you know, using his ratings as the setting the point spread, Michigan would be a 2-point favorite against Georgia on a neutral field. But also, Michigan would be a 8-point favorite against Notre Dame. Michigan is really good. Nobody can deny that. But it's not like Notre Dame has gotten worse since that game. In fact, that first game, they didn't start Ian Book, and they didn't have Dexter Williams. And I would say those two are the most important players on their offense.
I would agree. And, you know, our mutual friend and colleague Pete Sampson had a great tweet on Saturday night where he was talking about how good Dexter Williams was looking. And he said, imagine if they had had Dexter that night, maybe they would have beaten Michigan. I mean, it was a pretty funny moment. And I agree. We've got no problem. Michigan's having a great season. But I think, you know, Notre Dame is already the champions of the Big Ten, judging by whom they've beaten in the Big Ten and where those teams are going. So maybe Notre Dame should just claim that. If they go undefeated, there's no question they're going in. So it's and if they lose a game, I've got no problem with anybody keeping them out. Like, that's the way I always look at it.
For people who aren't subscribers of The Athletic, what are you waiting for? But if you don't read John's column, especially for me, like last week, we had a game in the middle of the day. There's a lot of stuff I didn't see. And I usually sometimes I don't get to see, I'm not watching half times of some of these games. You had an interesting lead to your bubble screen column this week, and it was about an exchange between Jim Mora, the former UCLA coach, and Emmanuel Acho, former Texas player. Mm-hmm. When you're planning on doing your column, is it just like, how do you organize in your head, just like waiting for, I don't want to say the outrage moment, but like that was a pretty, I didn't know that had happened. And then I read it. I was like, ooh, that is kind of interesting. And it kind of like resonates with a lot of people when you see that kind of like, because I do feel like on TV, and Stu and I have both been part of this a little bit, there is elements of manufactured debate. Mm-hmm. Not always manufactured, but in that case, when it kind of hits a level where it was like, whoa, that's out of bounds. That's the way you portrayed it. That's what it felt like there.
Right. And we're all veterans of television. Yeah, we've all worked in it, and we've seen the egos, and there's nothing wrong with a great debate, but there's a point where it gets personal for no reason. I remember having a debate once with a guy, I won't use his name here, but like, he kept interrupting me while I was talking, just constantly. And finally, I called him out, and he said on air, he's like, "What are you, soft?" And I just wanted to reach over the phone, and I'm not, it's like, this isn't what that's about. And what happened on Saturday night was Acho, who I think has got great energy on air and is a great hire by ESPN, was making a point because the conversation was, should Tua Tagovailoa have been pulled from the game earlier? And Jim Mora just went into, you know, complete coach mode. And I still don't understand the argument he was making. The argument I think he was making was that if you pull Tua, you're going to lose the locker room because they're going to think you're treating him with favoritism. He's a quarterback. Of course you're treating him with favoritism. It was such a dumb argument, first of all. And then when Acho tried to rebuke that, Mora interrupted him. And as I put in the column, his question was, how many national championships have you won? Which has nothing to do with anything. And as I put in the column, why didn't, you know, Acho could have just come back and said, how many Pac-12 championships did you win, Jim? So it was just a bullying, ugly moment. And I, if I'm, you know, the guy at ESPN, I'm not asking Jim Mora back next year. Because there's a point in this, and you guys were on Fox, you know, like, you have to be a team player. You can be argumentative, you can make points, but at the end of the day, you can't keep pissing off the guys you're on set with.
You know, in 3 years of doing this stuff on Fox, and I would often be in these panels with Coach Wonstead and Matt Leinart, who did win a national championship, and Joel, like, at no point did they ever go to the, well, you didn't play.
You didn't play.
You know, they respected the fact that I had was coming from my own perspective. You know, it's funny, Mora replaced Chip Kelly was on that show last year. By the way, not many people, it seems like it was kind of an accident that you even saw this. Like, who's watching the ESPN2 in between
right.
games studio show? But Chip Kelly,
for ESPN2, you were.
Chip Kelly was in that role last year, and I thought he was really good, and he, you know, fit in right. really well. And Mora, the few times I've seen it, it's just like, I don't know if he just doesn't want to be there or he doesn't have anything. And the thing is, he did TV for NFL Network. This is not new to him.
No, but some coaches just never going to get it. To go back to the question you had, Bruce, because this is what makes it so funny for me when you said, like, well, how do you know you're going to get this? It's a little bit like sitting there on October 15th. And because we're all veterans of this, we know something's going to happen that we can't plan. Like, between October 15th and December 1st, some upset that no one can foresee is going to take place. And you can't, like, you know, you can't just say, well, the season's over because every favorite is probably going to win. You don't know how it's going to happen, but you know it's going to happen. And I come in every Saturday with that sort of mindset. Like, I don't know where I'm going to find something, but I know if I watch enough college football, something is going to take place that's going to be worth writing about. But I can't foresee what it's going to be at 9 a.m. on Saturday morning.
Hey, John, go ahead.
So what you're saying is you just know human nature. One of these clowns is going to screw up, and I'm going to pounce.
Or something is going to happen. And one of these clowns is going to screw up. Or just something weird is going to happen. I can't remember what happened a couple of weeks ago. But it's always something with these. You know, there's just too many games. There's too many personalities. And there's too many great moments. There's a lot of stuff that just gets left by the wayside. I mean, I'm up at 2 in the morning watching USC Cal. And I'll be honest with you. At halftime, I thought, should I just go to sleep? But the end of that game, and I don't know if you had a chance to see it since, was fascinating. Because here you have a senior at USC, one of the best players on the team, just losing the game for them, basically.
Yeah.
With the kind of move you make in like freshman year of high school. It was astounding to me.
Let me ask you this. So here's a sports TV topic for you guys. So I tuned into the Clemson-BC game Saturday night. It was the ABC primetime game. I guess I just don't usually... I think I know, like, with those ABC games, you don't even need to turn them on until 8:15 because they're such a big... So for whatever reason, I had not seen this yet this year, but they do this whole intro that's like as if it's a TV show and showing, like, you know, the control room and the cameras are turning on, and then they do a big deal out of showing, like, Chris and Kirk and Maria as if they're, like, playing in the game. And it really... And the reason it came to my mind is, you know, and Joe Testor is our friend, and God bless him. He's a friend of the podcast, but he and his new Monday Night counterparts have taken a lot of flack this year. And I know that one of the criticisms has been that it seems like ESPN is trying really hard to make them be, like, the stars of the show. Like
the show.
Do people? I think Chris, Kirk, and Maria are absolutely outstanding, but do people really tune into Saturday Night Football because they know they're going to be calling the game?
Of course not.
Yeah.
There was one Howard Cosell. There's never going to be another Howard Cosell. And for those of us who remember him, like, that was a star. But they didn't do anything to promote. Like, I don't think Howard Cosell was in a montage in the beginning of Monday Night Football. It's got to be organic.
Yeah, I think some of it also, and I don't know how many of the 8 o'clock games I've turned on to see at the beginning either. So I don't know exactly what you're talking about, Stu, with that. But I do think some of it is
picture the beginning of like an 80s sitcom. Like it's very much where like they show like
big sweaters.
Like think of the intro to like Perfect Strangers or one of those shows where like the credits are rolling and like they did it was very much
now
in that
I would watch.
Yeah.
See now Stu, I'm imagining Chris Fowler riding down the bike path in Santa Monica and Herb Street going by
his head
him. And,
it wasn't that far from that.
By the way, you just made me think, Bruce, that the meme that everybody sees with the guy and his girlfriend and he turning back to look at the other girl, they created that on Three's Company, basically.
That's from where that stems from? Or you're kind of saying, you know, bringing it back to that? Or is that actually where it comes from?
That's where, the
genesis
Three's Company
of it.
Moment was 30 years earlier, yeah. So maybe you're onto something there. But to your point, Stuart, I mean, we're college football fans. I don't think we're looking at who's playing, right?
Right.
Aren't
right.
we like just sitting there and saying, what's the matchup?
Yeah. I mean, I think if it's a big game, you're going to watch it. And if it's like, I'll be interested to see what kind of ratings they get this Saturday night for UC. The primetime game is UCF Cincinnati, which is very unique and great for those programs. But college football fans have not to this point shown that they're all that interested in the Cinderella story, if you will. Like, I wonder what kind of ratings that will get compared to certainly not Ohio State, Penn State, but even this game this past week, the Clemson BC game. So speaking of broadcast crews, now we have to take Joe Davis, Brady Quinn, and Bruce Feldman out of this conversation. Just they're recused from this debate.
Why?
Who's your favorite?
It's not related to the fittest crew in TV. If that's the case, then we're taking it out.
Well, you are the fittest
crew
on TV.
It's funny, when I've tuned into this, I have not seen a Brady Quinn birthday cake. I've seen a Joe Davis
baby picture.
Here's my new baby picture. When are we going to get some Bruce Feldman up close and personal moments on that broadcast?
I'm scared that you're bringing this up because my producer, Bo Garrett, listens to this podcast. So I'm afraid what may be coming out of the woodwork after this comment, but Stu, please proceed.
I'm trying to think of what I could give him some material.
No, you don't need to give anybody any material.
Who's your favorite crew right now in college football television?
Wow, that's a good question. I would probably say Bob Wischusen and Brock Huard, mainly because of Brock Huard. I love Brock Huard, and I've said this before. They did a good little moment on Saturday where they came back to the booth and they were both wearing Gardner Minshew mustaches, which is a nice little touch. But saying that, there's not one that's unbelievably over and above everybody else. Like I love Sean McDonough and Todd Blackledge. I think they do a terrific job. You know, Joel Klatt is as good as it come as for me, play-by-play guys. You know, I feel like what happens, and I've been asked this before, I don't mention Fowler and Herb Street right up top. And it's just, I don't think they're the best. I think they're good. I think they get the great shows, but I think they're really solid. I just don't, it's not a meal that is memorable to me. Whereas like it's some of the guys who are a little bit off the beaten path. Another group, you know, I like Tim Brando and Spencer Tillman this year. I think they're doing a good job. There's nobody doing like a terrible job or anything like that. I would just say like week in and week out, I love Brock Huard's intelligence, his passion, and his candor. And for me, that's why I will listen to any game he does.
Stu, I'm gonna back what John says. The first time I ever worked with Brock was on this Overdrive show back at ESPNU, and he was filling in, and I learned so much about football from him in the break in the breaks where we would talk about stuff, not where he was talking down. He would just say anecdotally some of these things. I'm a big Brock Huard fan as well. Like, you know, I've seen him in his element. You know, he's a radio guy in Seattle. He's got, I think, more of a personality. I don't know if I would call it a dry sense of humor, but I think he's really, really good. So I'm glad you brought that up. John, I have a semi bone to pick with you. So this goes back to a week 2 game, and I wanted to throw this at you and give you, because I know I don't know if I would say you certainly tweet, but even the bubble screen feels somewhat stream of consciousness. And I think sometimes, as all of us, but certainly you, too smart for your own good, and your head is clouded with too much memorabilia that kind of surfaces. So I say all that to get to this. So we have the Stanford USC game week two, and I want to say I might have looked at Twitter or maybe this came up. You referenced the J.K. McKay, Pat Hayden high school connection in line with Amon-Ra St. Brown and J.T. Daniels. And
right.
Any thoughts? Oh, yes. Any thoughts this is going in? And I remember, so when I come into a game, I can't speak for the Holly Rose or Allison Williams or you know, how they do it necessarily, but usually I come in with like 10 or 12 sideline, you know, hits their little stories. And we had a bunch of Amon-Ra, JT stuff individually and separately, and together and separately. But the game didn't really kind of play out. That was a 17-3 game. Amon-Ra didn't do much. But I remember thinking afterwards, I was like, if I had brought that up, where it's, hey, we're going to talk about Pat Hayden, who USC fans now loathe, and something that happened probably 50 years ago, or 40, I guess it would have been 45 years, 50 years ago when they were in high school together, I'm like, man, there's no way we could bring that up. Now, I think that's something that's, you know, kind of maybe Dan Weber-ish, maybe, you know, somebody of that era, where, like, if you're a diehard USC fan, you might have made that thought. But I'm just thinking, I was like, there's no way I could bring that up.
I would say the only reason I would argue against that is that they were championship level team. If it was some team, USC team in the mid 80s that went 8-4, but those were some glory day USC teams, the Pat Hayden, JT McKay teams. And so I understand your point. I'm older than both of you. And so time is a flat circle. Like, the older you get, the more the years seem condensed. And yeah, anybody under 30 would just say, well, who the heck is that? It would be like somebody trying to tell me about Hapalon Cassidy or something. So I hear you there. It's a very valid argument.
Wow, Bruce, you've really been storing that up.
I've been saving this is why I
was. That was not where I thought that was going.
No, as I said, it wasn't a real bone to pick with you. It was more like, wait a minute, let me bat this one back.
That's a valid defense. But one thing I would want to ask is, why is everybody, and I know he's a freshman, but why is everybody so in love with JT Daniels? I haven't seen anything right now to merit, like, not that he's bad. It's just that, you know, the beginning of the year was USC quarterback. And by the way, and you didn't make this mistake, but how many guys were telling me how young he was as a freshman when
he was held back? Yeah, he's older. He is older as a starting quarterback than Khalil Tate was when he was a starting quarterback, when he started against them.
He had one great game, and that was when they beat Washington State, which turns out to be, you know, a really quality win in hindsight, the only game Washington State has lost. He and his receivers had a great game that night. But, you know, watching that game the other night against Cal, it's like, and I made this comment on Twitter, it seems like they've basically just resorted to JT, chuck it downfield, and hopefully one of your really good receivers will come down with it. Like, it doesn't
seem
like
play.
There's anything more nuanced going on in terms of, you know, his grasp of the passing game.
I think it's more a function of, you know what, he came from this high school modern day where Matt Leinart, Matt Barkley, and a former Notre Dame Heisman winner went to. So he had all these. I think Colt Brennan went there. He had this legacy program. He put up ridiculous numbers, and he's following Sam Darnold. And I think there is, and I'm guilty of this too, I think there is a rush from us in the media to always be out in front of who's the next one and be first, and plant our flag on saying, I wrote about this guy first, I sized him up first, you know, I anointed him first or whatever. And I think we got over, I mean, he still probably will have a really good career at USC, I don't know. But I think there was so much of a, let's plant the flag. And look, we at The Athletic did a story. I know Matt Hayes did a story. I felt like pretty much everybody nationally did their JT Daniels story before he even enrolled.
You know, in South Bend, we refer to that as Jimmy Clausen syndrome.
I think there's a lot going on there. I mean,
and by the way, one other thing on that. On the Jimmy Clausen thing, Ian Book, who I think the only other Power 5 offer he had was Leach at Washington State, he may end up having a better career you know, than some of these guys who go in as four or five star guys to South Bend.
He, you know, he's got two more years there, and you know, outside of your partner, could probably have the best career of anybody there in 25 years. Like, he's a good quarterback. He's not Tua Tagovailoa. Don't get me wrong. He is a good quarterback. If he were 6'3", he'd be an amazing quarterback.
I think the true freshman, I mean, first of all, with USC, I think the reason we were all rushing to write about him is that it really did feel like the whole season was going to depend on whether he was ready. And you see now that that was absolutely true. But you know, I think there's been a change in the last few years of expectations. When Jake Fromm takes his team to the national title game, when Tua does what he did in the second half of the national championship game.
True.
You know, Josh Rosen was pretty good as a true freshman. Like, there's no longer this, when it comes to those really highly hyped guys, and look what Trevor Lawrence is doing. You know, I think people just now say, like, well, okay, true freshman, big deal. Like, just because you're a true freshman doesn't mean you can't do it. When, you know, those guys, absolutely, the Trevor Lawrences are the rarity. Look at, you know, I know these Georgia fans keep wanting Justin Fields to play more and more, but when he does, you're like, I don't think he's ready yet.
Not yet.
Nothing wrong with that. No.
By the way, you guys are more studious on this, and probably you even more, Stuart, because Bruce has to work and fly every week. But do I have this right? Like, when Mac Jones was in the game for Alabama the other day, in another world, would Gardner Minshew have been the guy they'd have gone to?
Yes.
If he had decided to go to Alabama?
Yes. He, I mean, because that was the story I had reported on a lot in the offseason. He was going. And, you know, basically Hal Mumme, who was briefly at Jackson State, was not far from there. He obviously knows the air raid better than anybody, save for maybe Mike Leach, and would help give him a crash course. And it was like, his thing was, let me make one more run at this. Because the thinking was, when he first went through the recruiting process with Alabama, was, because I mean, what's interesting is, so Tennessee, he was waiting to see what happened with Keller Christ, you know, so it's Keller Christ ends up, you know, going there from as a grad transfer from Stanford. So it's like, okay, it's going to be Alabama. And the thinking is, well, maybe one of these guys will transfer. I'm the emergency guy, but if not, I get a head start on my coaching career, and I'm a de facto GA. And then, you know, Washington State is dealing with the tragedy of Tyler Holinsky. And how Mummy's out there in this, you know, Minshew's back in Mississippi. And so he's like, let me make a shot at one more time at the playoff. At the very least, I will learn the air raid system, and that could help my coaching career that way.
Crazy how that turned
out.
It's
a good story of the season.
I wonder if he had gone to Alabama, like, you know, at the time it was going into the season, the controversy was whether Jalen Hurts was going to lose his starting job. Would Jalen Hurts have lost the number two job?
I don't think Minshew would have been able to done enough to you know, like, because here's the thing. I think what happens with a lot of quarterbacks, and this is certainly an example of, you know, especially when you have a dual threat guy, they don't realize how good they are in practice until, like, people are actually trying to tackle them. And then they're like, wow, we can't get this guy down, or this guy makes this throw.
Right.
I don't think they would have known just how good Gardner Minshew is unless he's actually playing in the games.
Yeah. I agree. And he's found the perfect place for himself. Like, that just, it's nice when you see that happen. And when we've all watched enough times where you realize some kid just made the choice that wasn't the right choice for him school-wise, and he may pay for it with a couple years on the bench or maybe never seeing it. This was nice, because Gardner Minshew could have gone through his whole college career, and if he hadn't made this last choice, none of us would have really known who he is.
You know, we've always held up Russell Wilson as the, you know, the rare, because most of these grad transfers don't actually end up having that big an impact. Keller Christ is sitting on the bench at Tennessee. You know, we've always held up Russell Wilson to Wisconsin as the gold standard of that. But if Gardner Minshew ends up leading Washington State to a Pac-12 championship and maybe even a playoff spot, you know, that's as big, if not bigger, an impact than Russell Wilson had at Wisconsin.
Correct. And we're sitting here in South Bend saying, like, well, Everett Golson wound up at Florida State, Malik Zaire wound up at Florida. Does this mean that Brandon Wimbush is playing quarterback in Miami next year? Because he's not playing at South Bend.
Yeah. They could use him. I mean,
they probably could.
Interesting use of the big three, by the way.
Maybe UCF, if McKenzie's gone. But one thing, it was funny, and maybe you guys will find this interesting. When I was watching the USC game the other night, what stood out to me, and this is why college football especially is so much different than basketball or baseball, it's the difference coaching makes. Like, USC's got athletes. And as I explained to someone watching the game, like, the difference with football is coaching matters so much because you've got to do your job. You've got to have discipline into what your job is. And everybody's got to be coordinated because an average team of athletes that's really well coached can beat a great team of athletes that's poorly coached. And watching that USC Cal game on Saturday night, and I don't want to call Cal average, but relative, they were just a better coached team. And it's interesting. And watching Florida State, at least this season, it's the same thing. Like, it's so much fun as a connoisseur of this game to watch teams with less talent beat teams with more talent because what gets done between Sunday afternoon and Friday, it's so important.
Well,
that's
my
take on that.
Yeah. Well, I think when you look at some of these teams, you see, you know, I think sometimes we define talent as, okay, this guy was a 4-star, this guy was a 5-star necessarily, and sometimes it's not that. But, you know, look, I would use, John, the example. I'm watching Stu's alma mater this past weekend, They have 7 starters who Northwestern was their only Power 5 offer. The best player on the field was Isaiah Bowser, who's a freshman running back, who did nothing till a month ago. And then he faced a top 5 rush defense and ran for like 150 and basically put the team on his back. And, you know, the recruiting coordinator was telling me he didn't even have an offer from Cincinnati and his Ohio kid.
Wow.
But I think this speaks to really good coaches, especially at the college level. I don't want to say they can will a program to, you know, near the top 25, but I think Stu's alma mater with Pat Fitzgerald is a great example of that, you know, where it's in his image.
And
go ahead.
Right. But you do this freaks thing, you know, like in the freak, it's so entertaining to read your freaks pieces every year, but it's great to have freaks, but you also need like coaching. Nobody doesn't want a freak on their team, but a well-coached team is a really important thing. And the other thing really quickly, as a former high school wideout, that catch, is it Skaronek?
Skaronek.
Stewart, is that how you say it? Skaronek? That was the best catch I've seen all season. That was amazing what he was able to do, body control, arm control with that football.
I was worried that they were going to overturn it. Yeah.
Yeah, I was not far from it. I could not. It was one of those things where if it was ruled an incompletion, I'm not sure they could have overturned that. But and as somebody at Northwestern told me, that kid, before the game, I said, do you have anyone where it was like a head-to-head battle between Iowa and Northwestern? And that was the kid. And he turned out to be the hero of the game.
Oh, my God. Like, watch his arm control with that football. It's a catch. I mean, I thought it was totally a catch. But that's so hard to do, what that kid did. It was a really impressive play. And yeah, and Bowser, like you said, I agree 100%.
We're running out of time here.
No!
I mean,
no!
Our conversations with you, you know, we can go on forever.
Yes, John, you are like the Kaylee Hartung of The Athletic. We just you were one of our favorite people to have on. You're just a ray of sunshine.
Nice to hear.
That was quite a callback.
Well, thank you so much.
Kaylee came
What's
on.
That?
That was quite a callback. Kaylee came on what, like 3 years ago?
No, I think it was like before she left to go to CNN or whatever.
Well,
but I think that was
I remember we were both blown away by what a good guest she was. So take that as a high compliment, John.
Well, I really appreciate that. That's very nice of you guys to say. And, you know, now I'm just going to go back into my cocoon and wait until next year when I hopefully will get a call from you guys. So, you know, that's great. And I'll leave you and your listeners with one thing really quickly that's timely. This morning, if I'm reading this correctly, Georgia has announced series with both Texas and Clemson in the coming years. And my thought is, does Georgia know something about the end of days that the rest of us do not? Because I think maybe they're just making these promises knowing we're never going to actually hit the year 2029.
I mean, we could do a whole podcast on how stupid I think it is that these teams make these ADs make these deals 12 years ahead of time. You know, you don't know who the coach is going to be. You don't know what kind of shape your program is going to be in.
The AD's probably not going to be there.
Nobody involved in it's going to be there. And then whoever happens to be the coach in 2029, let's say they're in massive rebuilding mode and they're going, son of a bitch, who left me with this schedule, you know? So, yeah. Oh, by the way, John, the last thing I would say to you is, you know, you obviously probably offended some Michigan fans on this podcast. So just beware, Michigan's on a revenge tour. I don't know if you've heard this.
Oh, but it never leaves the Midwest, so I'm fine.
Okay.
It's like a Bob Seger tour, late 60s.
I'm just a little concerned that Chase Winovich is going to show up at your apartment and and invoke some revenge. But other than that, you should be all right.
I'll take it. I'll be fine with that. I'm going to be here. Even though Notre Dame is playing New York, I'm going to be on my couch on Saturday watching all the games, because that's what I do for The Athletic. I don't go to games. I'm here to serve you.
That's dedication, my friend.
You're welcome.
Thank you, John. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Guys, thanks so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right, Bruce, it's mailbag time.
What do you got for me, Stu?
And as always, everybody, send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We got a lot of good ones this week. From Mark Weaver, hi, Stu and Bruce. Love the pod. I got curious recently, given the dominance of Clemson and Alabama, both this season and over the last several seasons. So he looked it up and saw that either Clemson or Alabama has been the AP number one going back to the middle of 2015 when Ohio State was number one. That is pretty incredible. 3-year span, and you've only had these two teams as AP number one. If things hold form this year, it's highly likely that Clemson or Alabama will be number one at year's end. Who do you think will be the next team that's not those two, ranked number one, and when will that be?
That's a good question, because you would think they were going to be preseason number one. Tua is, you know, he can't leave for the NFL till after next season.
Yep.
So I think, and Trevor Lawrence is not going to get worse. I mean, he's going to be there at least 2 more years.
I mean, regardless of who wins the national championship, I would think Alabama would be preseason number one next year just because of Tua.
So, and also, you think Clemson's going to lose. They're going to have still a good D-line. They're going to lose a bunch of guys that decided to come back. So,
I have my answer.
Why don't you go first?
It'll be Georgia, and it'll be sometime next season.
You're banking on the big recruiting. Let me go further. Is Justin Fields going to be their quarterback when they're number one?
Gosh, that I don't know. Jake Fromm has done nothing to merit losing that job, and he's got at least another year.
Hey, what did Jalen Hurts do to lose that job? He had one shaky half.
But Jalen Hurts had a weakness. It was no secret he wasn't a great downfield passer. That is definitely not the issue for Jake Fromm. So I honestly don't know how Kirby's going to manage that. If Justin Fields might transfer, who knows? But they've recruited at such a high level. They're obviously not that far apart from Alabama and Clemson to begin with. So, I think they will contend for the national championship. First of all, they're not out of it this year, obviously, and I think they'll contend for it next year. So they will be number one at some point next season.
That's a pretty good answer. As you pointed it out, I think that's a pretty strong answer. I can't disagree. This next question from Josh Peterson. Stuart, in an email mailbag question over the summer, you were asked about Kirk Ferentz and his future at Iowa. All the concerns you seem to have come home to roost. Where is the program going under his tenure? Of all the years to get another division title, this is it. Wisconsin is down. Nebraska isn't there yet. Purdue was up and down. And yet, Iowa will be going to a middle-of-the-pack bowl game in year 20 under Kirk Ferentz. And if they finish unranked, it'll be the ninth time in the last 10 years they've done so. What do you make of that, Stu?
I think you feel vindicated? Well, first I had to look up what I said, and I now remember that it was about the fact that
they re-upped him to like 2027 or something like that.
They did that, and God bless their AD for one of the most one-sided deals in college football. No, it's the fact that Scott Frost comes to Nebraska. You know, I think it's been a rough year, but I think we both agree the future is bright there. If the Louisville job hadn't come open, Jeff Brohm was probably going to be there for a while. PJ Fleck is having a rough year, but future's bright there. Northwestern's not going anywhere. I mean, Iowa at this point is there's just nothing. They're not bad, but there's nothing there to make you feel like, oh, they're going to, next year, they didn't get it this year, but next year they'll win the Big Ten. Like this team had no reason to have 4 losses. They've got a decent quarterback. They've got an NFL tight end who Scott Docterman pointed out.
Two NFL tight ends.
Two NFL tight ends.
The other guy is really, really good.
And they've got a good defense, and yet they find ways to lose games like that one the other day. So I don't, The only thing I could say is that at least Kirk Ferentz has kind of become, you know, more relaxed and easygoing, and he goes for it on fourth down now. But in terms of larger picture, you know, why would you think that this is going to be anything other than a 8-4 on average kind of team?
I think they're good. I just think that where they are right now, I think they have three young linemen that they start on the O-line, and all those guys will be back. And the question has been, they have not run the ball very well. You know, Nate Stanley, I think, is very talented. And you said two tight ends. Now, I think they were shaky at receiver last year. They're much better at receiver. But the run game, Akram Wadley moved on, and they really haven't had an answer for that at this point. They have three running backs. We thought Mekhi Sargent, who started the Northwestern game, would have. He's a JC guy who has some buzz inside the program, but they really didn't get it done against your alma mater, Northwestern. And I think they're a good team. It wouldn't shock me if next year they had a better year and you start hearing, well, they're like more cohesive, or, you know, who knows what, you know, but just they just have been a little out of sync. And I don't know if there's any one reason to put your finger on that. I agree with what Josh said. I mean, no doubt Wisconsin's down, Nebraska is coming, but they are not there yet. Everything he said was right. And if you look at Northwestern, I mean, look, even if they had won that game this past weekend, Iowa still wasn't going to win the Big Ten West. It's just, I don't know. It's an odd year. And I still think he's a really good coach, but I can hear a little of the frustration. I get it, because they're talented, and this was the year to get that division.
You're always bringing up my coach rankings. Where would Kirk Ferentz be in your top 25?
He probably would be in the back of the top 25.
I don't think he'd be in my top 25.
I remember your top 25. He wasn't in there. Yeah. Obviously. I would put him over. Like, you had Rocky Long in there. You had a few other guys in the fringe. I'm like, I don't think that guy. I wouldn't have that guy in there. I mean,
Timeout. So you think, and this is bad timing, San Diego State just had a terrible loss to UNLV, but in general, he's been winning. You think it's more impressive for Kirk Ferentz he went to a Rose Bowl in 2015. Other than that, they've been kind of about 500 in the Big Ten for about 10 years now. You think that is a more harder thing to pull off than Rocky Long winning 10, 11 games a year at San Diego State?
I think Rocky Long is a really good coach, but also San Diego State is probably one of the is as good a job as there is in terms of you're surrounded by recruits compared to what, you know, the rest of the Mountain West has.
You also play in a dilapidated NFL stadium.
It's very little fan support. But again, the talent surround you in San Diego, that's better than any, like, you have the best talent base by far in that. I mean, go talk to Craig Bowl, or go talk to, you know, there's just not a lot of players in those other places, or go ask Bob Davey. I mean, it's just different. Again, Rocky Long's a really good coach. But I'm looking, I'm like, you know, what Kirk Ferentz has done is pretty impressive.
Well, if you're talking about over his career, yeah. I mean, I think he's 20 years at any place is amazing. And in that time, they went to a Rose Bowl. They went to two Orange Bowls. I think they won three Big Ten titles, though it's been a while since the last one. So, you know, in terms of career achievement, absolutely. But if you're naming who are the 25 best coaches in college football right now, this is Kirk Ferentz since 2010. 8-5, 7-6, 4-8, 8-5, 7-6, 12-2, Rose Bowl, 8-5, 8-5, 6-4.
You have a good leg to stand on. And to be honest, of the guys you have in your top 25, the only ones that I would say,
well, one of them got fired this weekend.
Yeah, right. I mean, do you regret having Petrino in your top 20? You had him like 15 or 16.
Good question. You were coming off the Lamar Jackson era. There was really no reason to think they would implode like this.
By the way, he wasn't the guy who wanted Lamar Jackson there. I know he's on his team, but wasn't like he was the one going out for him.
But the funny thing is, it's like I think I sent kind of a mixed message because I have him on that list, but I also forecasted exactly what happened, that they would implode once it was all his own players. So, you know, if you can't recruit and you can't manage a staff or hire a good staff, that's two-thirds of the battle. Your X's and O's can only get you so far. So, yes, in hindsight, I think I had him ranked too high.
So would you eat Kirk Ferentz over Bobby Petrino?
Well,
you know, we know he's a better human being.
One of them has a job right now, one of them doesn't. So I would have to say, I don't look. I mean, you're asking me that right now. As 2-8, just one of the most, you know, poorly coached teams in the country. So I don't think I could justify having Bobby Petrino over much of anybody.
Okay. Like, if I were, you know, just to throw this all out there, if I'm quibbling with your list, the three guys I would probably quibble the most at this point would have been Petrino as high as you had him, Gus, and Rocky Long.
Wow, you are not a Rocky Long fan.
No, I like Rocky Long. I just don't know if I would have him. You have Rocky Long ahead of Leach, by the way.
The thing with doing a list like that is it's hard not to get caught up in what happened the past season. You know, as much as I try to say, oh, it's about the last 3 years or 5 years or whatnot, like, you're coming off, when you're coming off the season Auburn had last year, you're going to be high on Gus Malzahn. I don't remember off the top of my head what Rocky Long did last year. I will look it up.
They were good.
They've been pretty good for a few years. And then somebody has a bad season and you look like an idiot. I remember I had Mark D'Antonio in my top 4 or 5 the year before he went 3-9. And at that point, you know, we weren't even sure whether he was going to get it back together, much less have the kind of season he had last year. So
look, I'm sure if you did this list again this year, you'd have to bump somebody because you'd stick Lincoln Riley in there. And you don't have him because he only had 1 year, and
that's
I get
right.
that.
Yeah, well, fortunately, Bobby Petrino vacated a spot for us, so it's not going to be very hard, and I don't think I'd have Gus Malzahn in there either. James Birdsong, hey, Bruce and Stu. I think a lot of fans are overlooking just how potentially chaotic the Group of Five berth to the New Year's Six bowl games could be. Goes to the highest-ranked Group of Five conference champion. UCF is the presumptive favorite, but if the Knights were to falter down the stretch, who replaces them? Cincinnati, Buffalo, Utah State, UAB, who you got?
All good, interesting choices. Here's one, and I'll be honest, and this is full disclosure. Stu, you pointed something out to me offline. Army, 8-2, and obviously not a Power 5 team, is not in the mix for that. But here, you know, Army has had such a great season, and one of their losses, they lost at Duke. Now, that wasn't that close, but they lost at OU, gave the Sooners all they could handle, and lose 28-21 in that pay-per-view showdown. First of all, do you think they should be in the mix for that? I mean,
they're an independent, so they're not.
Well, Notre Dame's an independent, though. They're, like, in the system.
No, Notre Dame doesn't actually have, like, some sort of guaranteed entry to that system. They just have to finish high enough.
Right, but my point, and again, now they're a two-loss Army team, not a one-loss. It's not their 9-1. But if they were, shouldn't they be eligible to play in that?
I mean, you're talking about a technicality. It goes to the highest-ranked Group of Five conference champion, and they're not in one of those conferences. So the only way they can get in is to just finish high enough, and I don't think they're even in the playoff rankings right now, are they? They should be. I'd love to see Army make the top 25 this week.
No, unfortunately for them, you know, they're coming off. They played Lafayette, who's an FCS, and they're going to play they're going to play Colgate. And they're going to get Navy, who's having the worst season they've had in a long time. Yep, so it's not going to boost their stock much.
No, they're not going to get in, obviously. The interesting one he brings up is UAB, who is, I believe, 9-1. And guess who UAB plays this week?
Is this a game where they're going to play an SEC school, I believe?
They are playing at Texas A&M. Uh-huh. Texas A&M did not, you know, this is the week almost every SEC team plays their body bag game. But unfortunately, A&M did not realize they were actually scheduling a really good team who leads the country in scoring defense. So, I mean, it's right there for the taking. I'm not saying they can pull it off or will pull it off, but if they beat Texas A&M, knowing how much respect the committee has for the SEC, I mean, Buffalo doesn't have a win like that. Cincinnati doesn't have a win like that. Utah State doesn't have a win like that. UCF doesn't have a win like that, although Pitt turning out to be a pretty good win for them. So,
by the way, you know, it's weird because I went back and, you know, the job that Bill Clark's done there has been really, really something. Their loss is kind of a head scratcher. They lost to Coastal Carolina, who is just a 500 team. And, you know, it wasn't even close. They won. Coastal Carolina beat them by like 3 touchdowns.
There's some sort of study or story to be done. I don't have an explanation for this. Maybe the coaches in these conferences could explain it. But you see a lot of those in the Sun Belt and Conference USA and in the MAC, where, not that there aren't upsets in the major conferences, but there are a lot more like that. Like, take a look at Old Dominion's season this year. They haven't, you know, they, what is their record? But they beat Virginia Tech. This week they beat North Texas, who's one of the better teams in that conference. And yet they've also lost to a bunch of bad teams. You know, you'll just see sometimes these inexplicable weeks where a team who's one of the better teams in that conference will suddenly lose to one of the worst teams. I don't know what that is.
It's weird because, like I said, this game wasn't even close. Now, Coastal blew the game open, and they outscored them 27-0 in the second half. But when you look at it, it wasn't like a bunch of turnovers. There was one turnover for UAB, none for Coastal. The only thing I look at is UAB had 15 penalties in that game. I'm sure that didn't help. So I don't know what the heck happened that day, but that's an interesting one. But anyway, as we digress into...
But to answer his question, you know, first of all, Boise State had a big win over Fresno State this past week, and now they'll play Utah State for that division. I think Fresno State will probably still come out the other side. So if it's not UCF, then probably next in line would be Cincinnati, assuming they run the table. And after that, I would think it would be the Mountain West. It's hard for UAB or Buffalo to have the strength of schedule. Though, like I said, UAB beats A&M and then wins Conference USA. That's a pretty good thing to have on your resume. James, you're a TV sports personality. Jamie Boyle from Grand Rapids, Michigan, mentions that he went to the Ohio State-Michigan State game this past weekend. And it reminded him of all the reasons why he loves college football, the band, the pageantry, all of that. But it also reminded him of the thing he despises most about attending a game, the endless wave of TV timeouts. True or false, in 10 years, when we watch a college football game, networks will have found a way to move to a World Cup-style format where only the TV timeouts only happen at the end of quarters or halftime.
Wow. I've seen some of that, like where I think Monday Night Football now has a similar kind of halftime where it's kind of rolls through and the ads. I don't know. I'm not a TV executive. I don't know how that would happen.
I think there could be some of that, but I don't think they would ever go entire quarters without commercial breaks. It's just the amount of money that the networks spend on this, they got to find a way to make it back. So
we have somebody in their truck who's basically one of their main jobs is making sure, you know, that part of the broadcast is balanced right. So, you know, I'm sitting down there and I'm obviously listening to the broadcast in my headphones, but I'm also listening to our producer. And so just on, you know, whether we're going to have, okay, this is going to be a sponsored element. This is going to be a half a minute. This is going to be a longer break. It's just, you know, there's such a tension to it because, like I said, you know, these are such huge deals that the networks are paying and the money and the business coming out. I just think that's just the reality of college sports as a huge business and a huge corporate business.
People don't realize this, but, you know, as much as live sports has become such a premium because people actually have to watch the commercials and they get big ratings, they often are still a money loser for the networks because they've spent so much on the rights that it's just almost impossible to turn around and make a profit off of it. So if you notice, if you watch a college football game now, and I've noticed Fox has a lot of these, they find more and more ways to work sponsors into the broadcast. Like Joel Klatt does like some sort of telestration. I forget what the sponsor is, but he has to actually say before the telestration, this is the AT&T smart blah, 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 you know, like,
We have like a Duluth trading toughest player, or I believe that's what it is.
Yep.
So that kind of sponsored element.
If any of these companies, by the way, would like to sponsor the Audible, they can email theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We're always open to new sponsors.
How about we get somebody to sponsor the weekly shout outs too?
I'm trying to think who would make sense for that. Who has something to do with shouting? Microphone company?
No, isn't there a get stains out of your clothes shout?
Ah, good point. As soon as we get off the podcast, I'll be looking up who the right person to contact is. I don't think they're going to advertise on a college football podcast. Nigel Campbell, Pullman, Washington. Guys, I was at dinner tonight and we were discussing Wazoo. I actually think that we are properly rated at 8th, maybe even slightly overrated if I'm honest. However, my brother insisted that if we were USC with the exact same credentials, we'd be number 4 or number 5. My argument back was that the committee was supposed to disregard brand names and that wouldn't be the case. Do you two feel like they, the committee, actually do a good job of disregarding brand names, or do you feel like it frequently swings their judgments?
I think it does. I think they're both right. You know, when he's talking about if they were USC, well, let's be honest. If they were USC, they'd be playing Notre Dame. USC plays a much tougher non-conference than Wazoo plays. USC also played at Texas, whereas Wazoo's non-conference is not helping them at all. I mean, it's like,
Remember, Washington 2 years ago had a very similar terrible non-conference schedule and same record, and they were this was not an issue for them. So I think he's right.
I think, but also, Stu, I think some of what's happened, and this is, I don't know if it's fortunate or unfortunate for Washington State, the Pac-12 was really down last year, obviously 1-8 in the bowls. They're even further down if you look at how the perception of the league is this year. So who are the teams we thought were going to be good? We thought Washington was going to be really good. Well, they're not really good. They're pretty good, but they're not really good. Stanford, down. Oregon, probably a little worse than what we had thought. USC, I didn't think they'd be very good. They're even worse than that. I mean, the only one who I think in the conference, other than Washington State, who has like exceeded expectations is Arizona State, just because we all thought Herm would burn three timeouts before the first play of the game. You know, it was just
turns out he's competent.
yeah. So
well, looking at it now. First of all, by the way, Washington State could potentially win the Pac-12. And be 12-1, and at the end of the season, not have a single win over a team that finishes ranked. I mean, Washington was 25th last week, so even
and
beating
they're not
going
to get it. They're not going to get a ranked win over a team in the South. I mean, I assume maybe Utah can go 9-3, and then they'd beat them. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think Utah 9-4 would still probably be in the top 25.
I mean, that's probably their best hope is Utah's 9-3, and they would probably be in the top 25, but. You know, they could end up playing ASU or Arizona, who would not be ranked. So if I'm looking at it right now, saying they would be number five, you look at the teams that are ahead of them. I don't think if this were USC with the exact same resume, would they be ahead of Georgia? No. Would they be ahead of Oklahoma? No. I do think they'd be ahead of 7-2 LSU, though.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah.
So, minimal bump there. But I think brands play a big part in the committee, but they play a big, I mean, they play a big name for all of us. Like we're all susceptible to brand bias. It's a big part of college football, and I just think those guys are human. Finally, from Scott Schwarzkopf, Stu and Bruce, longtime listener back to the Fox Sports days. Thank you very much. It increasingly looks like my Buffs are going to lose 7 straight to finish the season and move on from Mike McIntyre after the season. That had not dawned on me that it's true. They started 5-0 and they've lost 5 straight since then. Given the challenges of the job, who do you think is a realistic target for the Buffs as their next head coach? Well, let's just start with, if that happens, if they go 5-7, do you believe they'll fire McIntyre? Related, if they do find a way to get to 6, would he save himself?
I think if they lose the last 7, especially, you know, I think I started hearing a lot of this chatter inside college football circles after that Oregon State loss. I think it's a very real possibility that they could have a coaching change there.
They close with Utah at home this week, obviously big game for the Utes, and then they're at Cal, who I'm going to chalk that up as an L, the way Cal's playing.
Yeah, look, there's one of the names I could see them going for, and he hasn't been that receptive, but it might be one he'd consider, is Boise State's Brian Harsin. I could see that being a possibility there. You know, it's one of those where you look at it and go, okay, well, who would make some sense? Would they go after like a Jimmy Lake, who's in the conference, is a really well thought of defensive coordinator at Washington? I could see that being a job that, like, I know he's somebody who's going to be really choosy when it comes to opportunities, but I think that'd be a hard one to turn down. I don't know if a Ryan Day, who's coached 3 games at Ohio State, I think his name will come up, and I could see that being a possibility.
Let me just make a little bit of a counterpoint here. Like, and I'm not at Colorado. I don't know what the fan kind of, where they are right now, but if you can't come up with an obvious, like, you know, Louisville, Jeff Brohm, obvious, home run. If there is no obvious name like that, maybe you don't need to fire Mike McIntyre. He did win 10 games 2 years ago. I don't think he's forgotten how to coach. And also, I mean, think about the run of coaches they had before him. you know, do you really want to risk ending up with another John Embry, Dan Hawkins? You know, these guys set that program back tremendously. So that would be my gauge. Like, is it really the end of the world if he goes 5-7? Do you not think he could turn around next year? Laviska Shenault will be back, among others, and go 7-5 or 8-4?
Well, that's a fair point. Look, I mean, I think a lot of what you said is common sense, but I think it can be a tough sell, especially how bad the South, the Pac-12 South has been this year.
Right.
So I don't know. It's not the AD who hired him, and I think there's some, you know, frustrations clearly building.
Could they get Matt Wells?
I think they could get Matt Wells. No. I definitely think they could.
I think that would be a smart one.
Yeah, he's a good coach, and he's one of these guys who was kind of a hot name 2 years ago, and then he had a down year, and now Jordan Love is playing really well, and he's somebody who I think, like, I don't know how much time you spend around him, but like Matt Wells is like, I feel like anybody who's around him comes away really liking him. He's a very, very likable guy, and I think you see how he's done there. Like, he's, you know, I mean, that's not that easy of a job there. And he's done well. I think he's a hot name, or will heat up now, certainly with this year. It's just, you know, this is not going to be a year. Now, there may be some domino effect. Look, I mean, you mentioned, we talked a little bit about Bobby Petrino in Louisville. Certainly, if Jeff Brohm does take that job, I mean, I could see Purdue maybe trying to replace him with Neil Brown. I mean, then, you know, I think that would open up the Troy job, and you get a little bit of dominoes. Where you don't get the dominoes when the coordinators get hired, but we'll see. I mean, I think there will be much less than we had last year, but, you know, if a USC opens up, if some of these other ones come open, and, you know, we could certainly see K-State opening up, Colorado potentially, maybe Rutgers. I don't know. It's tough to get a read on what's going to happen because, like I said, I was under the impression from people I talked to close to USC that Lynn Swann, the AD there, was very, very in the corner of Clay Helton, want to give him every chance as long as the bottom didn't drop out. Well, they lost to Cal, and if they lose this weekend to UCLA, I think that would be defined by a lot of people if the bottom's dropping out.
I mean, if they lose to UCLA, he's done. There's no way you could bring him back. UCLA's 2-8. But I guess the question is, if they beat them and lose to Notre Dame and finish 6-6, is Lynn Swann ready to support him? You know, Clay Helton pointed out that, you know, Clay Helton was defending himself and pointed out that, hey, you know, Notre Dame had a bad year a couple years ago, and look at them now. I would say the difference is Brian Kelly had already gone to a national title game at that point. So I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, the difference is Brian Kelly, a lot of people wanted him early on, whereas I don't think anybody at USC was really in Clay Helton's corner that strongly.
I mean, it would be very uncharacteristic of a major college football program if he actually did bring him back, even at 6-6, because the fans have already given up on him. So how are you going to sell people on next season when everybody's already kind of made up their minds that he's not the guy that's going to lead them to glory? So, by the way, real quick on Matt Wells, you mentioned that he had a down year. He actually had a down. It's an interesting trajectory he's had there. 9-5, 10-4, then 6-7, 3-9 in 2016, back to 6-7 in a bowl game last year, and now here they are 9-1, top 15 in the AP poll. And the interesting thing is Matt Wells made his reputation on defense, but this year's team, I mean, they put up 800 yards this past weekend. They are one of the most powerful offensive teams in the country.
All right. You want to do our shout-outs?
Yes.
All right, you want me to go first?
I want you to go first, yes.
Okay. My shout-out is to Pat Narduzzi, the Pittsburgh head coach. A lot of people have written them off. I think people wondered why he got the contract extension. But in the last, really since September ended, the Panthers are playing about as well as anybody outside of Clemson. They beat Syracuse, which looks like a really good win. They gave Notre Dame their toughest game on the road, barely lost that. Beat Duke. One at West Virginia, who was ranked, and just blew out Virginia Tech. And all of a sudden, Pat Narduzzi's run game is out of control. Against Duke, they ran for almost 500 yards. And against Bud Foster's defense this past weekend, you know how many yards per carry they averaged?
I know they had 492.
14 yards.
Holy moly. I made sure to let Dave Wanstead know that 492 yards is the most since Tony Dorsett was back in the backfield for them.
Yeah. So shout out to Pat Narduzzi. He's got it going a little bit. We'll see. I mean, look, by the way, they did, if I'm not mistaken, didn't they knock off the Clemson team that won the national title?
They did.
They did. So
it's a weird thing where they knocked off 10-0 Miami last year. So they've had these moments, but they just haven't really been able to string it all together. But right now it does look like they're going to win that division.
By the way, and we can, I don't know if it's even grammatically correct to call Wanstead Narduzzi's predecessor, or he's being his predecessor, because there was like 11 coaches in a 6-year span.
And he most definitely was not his predecessor.
But Wanstead had that giant killer, you know, fly in the ointment win over West Virginia that when he was at Pitt. So don't count out the Panthers for shocking us.
Okay. My shout out is going to go to Tony Sanchez at UNLV. It's been, I don't know, how long since UNLV was good? A couple decades?
Probably since Suge Knight was playing there.
And he certainly looked like now he would be the latest one to come and go there, and maybe he still will, but they got off the mat. They won at San Diego State against, you know, your most overrated coach in America, Rocky Long.
I didn't say that. Come on.
San Diego State, obviously, really good team, 7-3. They go there on the road, beat him 27-24. They're still only 3-7, but at least he's showing some signs of life there. We'll see how they finish it out.
All right. Very nice.
As always, guys, send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. And you know, some of you have emailed us telling us you love the long podcast. Well, guess what? This one is going to be probably checking in as our longest ever. So congratulations. You're going to get this super duper bonus episode off. Strangely enough, one of the most uneventful weekends of the season. So funny how we stretched that out, Bruce.
All right. Well, I wasn't trying, but it happened that way.
We'll see you next time.
If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the Audible at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. We'd like to thank our producer, Nick Fink, and we'd like to thank Kevin and the Octaves for our intro song, Dangerous. You can download their music on iTunes or Spotify. If you haven't subscribed to The Athletic yet, what are you waiting for? Read both myself and Bruce and all our other great writers there. Go to theathletic.com/theaudible and get 25% off. You can also follow our coverage at The Athletic CFB. You can follow me at SL Mandel. Follow Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB. We'll see you next time. Get over here.